Vayomer Adonai El Moshe Bo El Paro Ki ani hichbadti es libo v'eslev avodav leman shisi ososai eile bikirbo. Hashem said to Moshe, come to Paro, for I have made his heart and the heart of his servants stubborn, so that I can put these signs of mine in his midst. OU Israel presents
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Bo. Recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, the fourth day of Shavat, 5776, corresponding to January 14th. Let's do Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed first, and then I will explain two things, or a couple of things about the opening of the show, and then we'll get into the nitty-gritty of some of the content of Parshat Bo. Shir hama'alot mima'amakim karaticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli tihyena oznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmor yoh Adonai mi amod ki imcha hasalicha l'ma'an tivarei. Kiviti Adonai kivita nafshi velidvoro hochalti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. Zehu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achinu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara v'ashivya. Ha'omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha. Hamakom yirachem aleihem v'yotziyem mitzara lirvacha u'me'afela l'ora u'mishibud l'geula hashta ba'agala u'vizman kariv v'nomar amen. Okay, first things second things first, the opening verse of Parshat Bo. Actually, before I get into that, I want to thank the many listeners who emailed me as per my request two shows ago, and I will acknowledge you each by email in the coming period of time. But I thank you and appreciate your comments and feedback, because sometimes I get that eerie feeling that I'm sitting here in my office talking to myself, recording a show, sending it out, but takes a lot till it gets to your ears, and it's good to know that there are ears out there from many different parts of the world, as well as here in Israel, who are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio. So I thank you all. The opening verse in Parshat Bo has a point which is made a few times at the end of last week and the beginning of this week, and it demands our attention, as it captured the attention of many, many Torah commentators, and their explanations differ widely. It's the idea of ki ani hichbadti et libo, that I have hardened Pharaoh's heart and made him stubborn in order to present my signs, wonders, and miracles in the form of the plagues that were rained down upon Egypt. The obvious question is that when Moshe first asks Paro to let the people go, and he says no, And Moshe says, if you don't do that, there's going to be a plague, and it's going to be, all the water is going to turn to blood. And Paro says the equivalent of, who are you and who is this God you're talking about? And goodbye, out of here. And the plague of blood comes, and Moshe and Aaron are returned to the king's palace. And he said, okay, just get rid of the blood. And he does, and then he says, no, I changed my mind, you can't go out. Now, a person can change his mind. A person can steel himself to punishment and abuse. And notwithstanding that, make a decision according to what he would like to. And he didn't let them out. And the same thing happened after frogs and after lice and after wild animals and after the disease that killed the livestock. And when we get into the second half of the plagues, last week Shechin and Barad, this week Arbe Choshech and the ultimate one Makat Bechorot, we find the change in language from Paro hardening his heart to God hardening Pharaoh's heart. So the question is this a removal of a person's free will? Is Paro not able to exercise his free will choice because God hardened his heart and he refused to let the people go? Might he have let them go if God had not hardened his heart? And which is free will and which is not? Which is a key to this whole idea. So the one school of thought says that a person, a human being, generally has free will, but it has a limit. The limit is usually the person's death. When a person dies, he has no free will to exercise. So whatever free will he had to do good or to do bad ends when he dies. That's sort of an obvious. Then you have to add to that, when a person becomes incapacitated through illness or infirmity, old age, and is not capable of doing certain things that he might like to, then his free will has in essence been curtailed or even taken away. And that also is kind of obvious. Here we have a situation where, again, according to one school of thought, God did to Paro the equivalent of either ending his life or making him have a stroke and go into a coma, but while he was alive and while he was conscious. In other words, God said, Ad kan, until here, free will is given to people, and in your particular case, Pharaoh, I am removing your free will in order to carry out the plagues and the events of the Exodus the way I want for the world to see and mostly for the people of Israel to witness. So that school of thought says, yes, you're right. Paro had no free will at this point. This is not why he was punished. He was punished when he exercised his free will to enslave the people, to oppress the people, to kill the babies and others, and refusing to let them go, and refusing to let them go, and refusing to let them go. At a certain point, free will taken away. Remember, this is one school of thought. And there is a plan that God has, which involves Paro not being able to interfere with it. As I said, this is one school of thought. Which school of thought? I would have to do some more research and to actually list the commentators who come down on that side. There's another side of the coin which personally I am intrigued by, and I like the idea, and that is hardening Pharaoh's heart not only does not take away his free will, it ensures his free will to make his own decision. In other words, if I say you have two choices, A or B, which do you choose? A. Slap in the face, which do you choose? A. Harder slap in the face, which do you choose? A. A punch in the face that breaks your nose, which do you choose? A. At a certain point, when the punishment gets harsher and harsher, the person is going to say, okay, B. Not because he wants to choose B, but because he has taken as much punishment as he can handle. Hardening his heart, so to speak, whatever exactly that means, allows Paro to have the resolve to do what he wants to do, which means not let the people go, retain them as slaves, deny that there are powers in this world beyond his. He wants to keep them enslaved, and God's hardening his heart allows him to resist plague after plague, because only an idiot would remain stubborn after all the beating that Paro and his people had. And the point was, harden him, steel him, so that if he says, yes, they could go, it's his decision, not because he's being beaten. And if he chooses, which he did over and over again, not to let them go, that is really a free will decision. That's my read of it. I prejudice you maybe a little by telling you that's the one that I like better than the other one. But I go with the first one as well because, as an analogy, the fact that there are people who, well before their death, in essence, do not have the ability to exercise free will is a well-known thing from people who have dementia or Alzheimer's or some other kind of debilitating condition in their later years, which in essence ended their free will behavior to a great extent. So that's what I have to say about that first verse. As far as the opening song, I'm sure you recognized it as Simon and Garfunkel's Sound of Silence, and it came to me to use it for Parshat Bo because of two things. The opening line is, "Hello, darkness, my old friend," and that immediately brought to my mind the ninth plague, the second one of the three in Parshat Bo, namely the plague of darkness. Now, "Hello, darkness, my old friend," is certainly no friend of the Egyptians, because this was an extremely debilitating darkness, an unnatural kind of darkness, and not merely the absence of light, but the presence of a dark force in a darkness. It was friendly to the people of Israel, because the people of Israel had light, were able to see, and according to some of our sources, when an Egyptian and an Israeli would be standing next to each other, the Israelite would be able to see clearly, and the Egyptian would be in total darkness, like blindness, but not. Furthermore, there are sources that tell us that it was during the period of darkness that Jews who were not to be redeemed from Egypt died off, and it did not create the you're in bad shape also kind of feeling on the Egyptians, which would have detracted from the extreme contrast between the Egyptian and the Israelite. Furthermore, there are sources that tell us that it was during the darkness that the Jews were able to take those items which the Egyptians were giving them or thinking of giving them or whatever, and in fulfillment of the prophecy originally to Avraham Avinu of Va'acharechein Yetzu Birchush Gadol, and after the oppression and the slavery, they will leave with great wealth. So, Hello Darkness, my old friend, sort of fit that idea of Choshech vis-a-vis the Jewish people, the Israelites. The name Sound of Silence reminded me of two other things related to this Sedra. One is the fact that Sound of Silence seems to be an oxymoron, where silence is the absence of sound. But the sound of silence is sometimes as loud and as penetrating and revealing as any noise could be, maybe more so. So the idea of silence being the absence of sound, or not, but silence being a different kind of sound, that there is such a thing as the sound of silence, reminded me of what I just mentioned before, that the darkness of Choshech, the ninth plague, was not a mere absence of light, but it was a presence of a force called darkness. So that's what Sound of Silence reminded me of. Furthermore, it reminded me of the utter contrast between the Egyptian neighborhoods and the Jewish neighborhoods during the final night before leaving Egypt, the night of Makat Bechorot, the killing of the firstborns, where you had a situation where there was screaming and all kind of noise in the Egyptian areas, and in the Jewish areas, there was the sound of silence. And the Torah uses as an illustration of how different it was by the expression, Lo yecheratz kelev lishono, a dog didn't bark. Dogs usually bark. It's a normal thing for dogs to do, especially when they perceive and sense death. So the deaths of the Egyptian firstborns, I am sure, was responded to by Egyptian animals with all kind of loud sounds, and certainly by the people. But in the Jewish areas, not only was it calm and quiet and peaceful, but even Lo Yecheratz Kelev Lishono, without dogs barking, you have a sound of silence. So I decided that it would be a good opener for the show. In last week's show, I had a few Pesach Haggadah songs to keep us or put us into that mood. If I have time, I will put on another one of those, maybe from a different album. But definitely Parshat Bo is a Seder night Parsha. Let me turn this upside down. We're now standing at the beginning of the month of Shavat. Last show I told you we're a day before Rosh Chodesh Shvat. I'm sorry, a couple of days before Rosh Chodesh Shvat, right before Rosh Chodesh benching of Shvat. So beginning of Shvat means all of Shvat, all of Adar Rishon, all of Adar Sheni, and half of Nisan is 3.5 months till Pesach. Now it's less than 3.5 months, going on 3+. And yet, the Torah's readings of Shemot, Vo'era, Bo, B'Shalach, Yitro, are the readings that really belong in the period from Pesach till Shavuot. In fact, some of the readings now, parts of them, are read on the days of Pesach. So what are they doing here? Well, you could say they're doing here because the way the Torah is divided into 54 weekly portions, some of which are sometimes combined, in order to fill out the whole year's reading. So this is where we're up to. what does this have to do with Pesach? The answer is really nothing. On the other hand, it's a good thing that we have an opportunity, not Pesach time, when things are busy with cleaning and preparing for Pesach, and review of the laws of Pesach and the Seder laws and the Haggadah content, it's nice to be able to take a look at it at a different time of the year, which is also appropriate, as I said, because of the Parsha. And that's what we're doing. We did last week, and we're doing a little bit more of that now. So, let's look at the following. When the sages that were in charge of organizing how we are supposed to mark and celebrate the Seder night, when they edited Haggadah, they had many choices to make, what goes in and what doesn't go in among them. So when the topic of the story of the Exodus was broached, which is a mitzvah from this week's Sedra, V'higadta levincha v'yom ha'hu le'mor, and on that night you shall tell your children the following. So that means we need a suggestion, a structure as to how to go about telling the story of the Exodus. The primary sources are the Sedras that I've mentioned, Shemot Va'era Bo Bishalach. And if we had, instead of a half of a night from dark until midnight roughly, instead of that, if we had a couple of months to celebrate the Seder, then maybe our texts would be Shemot Va'era Bo and Bishalach. And for that, you need not half of a night, you need a long shear, week after week after week, day after day, and then eventually you cover that ground. Hold that thought. We'll be right back with more Torah Tibbetz audio for Parshat Bo. Continuing the idea from before, so what did our sages do? They found a brief summary in the form of part of the recitation of the Bikurim bringer, the one who brought first fruits to the Beit HaMikdash, to the temple, had to make a statement. That statement included a brief summary of, we went down to Egypt as a family. We were oppressed. We called out to God, and he took us out. Great. And they built a whole Haggadah around that as the main fulfillment of the mitzvah to tell the story. But here we are able to discuss Pesach issues now without having anyone say, why now, why not some other time? Because this also is a time. Now I want to move on to one of my all-time favorite topics, as those regular readers of Torah Tidbits certainly know, and listeners of Torah Tidbits audio, I am sure, picked it up also, and that is the Jewish calendar. I try to hit it from new angles all the time, and I hope that this week, both in the lead tidbit and now on the show, expressing it differently, I will succeed in not being more of the same. But we are focusing now, about to focus, on the very first mitzvah that was commanded to the people of Israel as a soon-to-be nation, the mitzvah of setting up our own calendar. Now, we don't do it as individuals. We do it as a unit. Our unit is represented in the first case by Moshe and Aharon, and for future generations by the Sanhedrin, the great court of 71 elders. We are in a period of many centuries without a Sanhedrin, but we were not left high and dry without the proper procedures for setting up our calendar, and I will be talking about that shortly.
30 days have September, April, June, and November. All the rest have 31, except February alone, which has 28 days clear, and 29 in each leap year.
I often recite that ditty, not sing it, but recite it, when I am about to talk about the Jewish calendar, because the fact is that many, many, many Jews, especially those from countries native other than Israel, are very well aware that September, November, etc. have 30 days. But if you ask them, what's today's date in the Jewish calendar? Not many will know that it's the 4th of Shavuot. Maybe, since it was recently Rosh Chodesh on Monday, they'll count Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, the 4th of Shavuot. And people who are not aware of that are not going to have an answer either. And if you ask how many days in Shavuot, I don't know how many who know clearly that both July and August have 31. We'll know that Shavuot in our fixed calendar is assigned 30 days. And that means that the coming Rosh Chodesh, this year of the first Adar, is a two-day Rosh Chodesh. So I presented it here in a Mother Goose, from a Mother Goose piece on YouTube, just to make that point and to hopefully make people more aware of the Jewish calendar. Many different points to start from, but let's just say that a Jew should know his Jewish birthday. For a boy, it's essential at bar mitzvah, and a girl at bat mitzvah. But aside from that, it's an important thing to know. God gave a gift to the Jewish people on our way out of Egypt. He said to us, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim, this month of Nisan, in which you are coming out of Egypt, is your first month of the year. And therefore it behooves us to know a lot about the calendar. It starts with what's your birthday. And there are many websites. You just put in a search in Google for Jewish calendar or Gregorian-Jewish calendar, and you'll get conversion programs, secular civil calendar, Jewish calendar, however you want to call it, you'll find them, and you'll be able to plunk in your birthday as you know it in the secular calendar, and it will tell you your Jewish birthday. And the other piece of information that you need to know is whether you were born on that day before sunset or after sunset, and that will determine one day or the other in the Hebrew calendar. But that's, you know, a detail. I am living in Israel for 34 years. Every single time, there has been no exceptions to this, and it's countless times that I have written checks, I have dated them in the Jewish date, because it is legal to do that in Israel, because banks go by both calendars and they readily recognize the Jewish date. It was one of the earliest things that gave me that feeling of I am where I want to be. Because even if I wanted to date a check in the States with a Jewish date, I wouldn't be able to do that. I was challenged in all these years twice. Once a person said, I'm embarrassed to ask you, is that today's date? Because she wanted to make sure that I wasn't post-dating a chick. And the other time was a guy in a gas station. I think he was an Arab, non-Jewish. And he said, you can't write that. You have to write the regular date. I said, yes, I can. And I left it. And he took out his pen and he jotted down the secular date right next to my Jewish date. I'm not claiming that it's a halachic requirement, but I am claiming that it is a fulfillment and an appreciation of HaChodesh Hazeh Lochem Rosh Chodeshim. This month and this calendar is yours, God said. I have a particular thing which I've seen in earlier sources, but not everybody agrees. We had a nice piece in this week's Torah Tidbits by Shimon HaKohen Nadel about the use of the secular calendar, and he brings down different opinions. But I have a hakpada, an insistence of not numbering the secular dates when I have to write them on forms. And I won't call January month number one, because the Torah says, for you, the Jewish people, month number one is Nisan. So how can I go and say, no, thank you, I'll call January month number one? I know there are people who raise objections to the Greek and Roman gods that are memorialized in some of the names of the months. And I think that's less problematic than the number. Not everybody agrees with that, but that's not what I want to get to now. What I want to present briefly, and there's, aside from information, there is a real goal that I have, which I hope to get to. And that is what I call Plan A and Plan B of the calendar. Plan A operates when we have a Sanhedrin sitting in Jerusalem, or a duly authorized Sanhedrin, other places which happened after the destruction of the Second Temple. But let's say mostly Jerusalem, exclusively Jerusalem. Ki mitzion teitzei Torah, from out of Zion shall go Torah, udvar Hashem mirushalayim, the word of God from Jerusalem. When we have a Sanhedrin, Plan A, without too much detail, calls for eyewitness testimony to the first visibility of the lunar crescent, testifying before a select committee of Sanhedrin members in the headquarters of Sanhedrin, half on and half off of the holy part of Har HaBayit. And based on that testimony, the proclamation in the morning after sunrise by the Nasi of the Sanhedrin, the president of the country, we'll say, declaring the day as holy, making it Rosh Chodesh, making any holidays that fall out in that month also have their sanctity. I am avoiding, at great restraint here, going into detail about everything that I say. But we start with eyewitness testimony to the new moon and proclamation based on that testimony. A very important idea is that witnesses did not come because the judges of Sanhedrin had no clue as to what was in the sky and what wasn't in the sky. In fact, the judges of this committee in Sanhedrin were required to know accurately the paths and orbits of the heavenly bodies, to know exactly when and where the first visibility of that lunar crescent would be, so that they could intelligently question witnesses and determine whether the witnesses actually saw what they claimed to or not. We'll get into that a little bit more in a moment, but basically, judges, pre-knowledge, eyewitness testimony, sanctification by the Nasi the following morning. A Jewish month in that system of Plan A can have only 29 or 30 days, not fewer than 29, nor more than 30. And the judges had certain discretionary powers of proclaiming the day that should have been Rosh Chodesh, especially in winter time, where skies all over might not have been clear enough to see that first piece of the new moon. But the calendar was essentially based on eyewitness testimony and the proclamation of Sanhedrin, and then the counting of what happens during that month proceeds. So let's take Nisan as an example. Rosh Chodesh Nisan is not only valuable for itself, but it determines Pesach. If Rosh Chodesh Nisan is on a Tuesday, then 2 weeks later, on a Tuesday, will be the first day of Pesach. And Monday night, the night before, will be the Seder. And the sanctity of Pesach depends upon the sanctity of Rosh Chodesh of that month. The previous month, Adar, in those days, past and future, might have 29 days or might have 30. We don't know for sure until the end of the month. Which means that during Adar, right after Purim, I can't say to you, you're invited to my Pesach Seder, which will be, and specify the day of the week and the date. We don't know yet. It fluctuates. That's not the right word, but that's the word that popped into my head. That's Plan A. Plan A is a little bit last minute, a little open to variables, and even to human error, to the point where the Rambam writes in his Hilchot Kiddush HaChodesh that if a Sanhedrin makes a mistake, either on purpose or by accident or inadvertently, take away the on purpose because I don't think they could do it on purpose, but if it happens that they make a mistake, their mistake stands to determine when Rosh Chodesh is, and anyone who has the proper calculation as to when it should have been has to follow the Sanhedrin and cancel his own calendar, even God. Won't get into that at the moment. Plan B is for when a Sanhedrin is not sitting, like now. And Plan B is based on a mathematical calculation that does not require witnesses to cite the new moon, does not require an act today of sanctifying the new moon. That has been done already by an early Sanhedrin who invested the sanctity in this mathematical procedure, so that every month, month in and month out, and every year, and every Shana Mu'uberet, the extra month of the year like there is this year, is already determinable by mathematical calculation and duly sanctified by a former sitting Sanhedrin. You can have a 2-year calendar, a 5-year calendar, a 10-year calendar, a 200-year calendar, and if you have a good computer program for the calendar, of which there are many, you can have thousands and thousands of accurate years and months according to this mathematical system. It is what we use. There are no mistakes in it. And you know it so far in advance that you could plan not only who's coming to your Seder this year, but next year and the year after as well, if you're that kind of person. So originally it was Plan A, and then it became Plan B. And when we have a new Sanhedrin, may it be speedily in our time, we will go back to Plan A, a less efficient, potentially in error kind of system with a way of handling it, etc. One more thing to throw in to the pot. If the night in question, when it's possible to see the moon for the first time, but it's not 100% sure, or even if it is sure, but there's cloudy conditions which might obscure the moon, and witnesses see what they think might be the first visibility of the lunar crescent on a Friday night, no matter where they are in Israel, they get into their car and they drive to Yerushalayim in order to testify in what would ordinarily be a violation of Shabbat. Now, without going into all of those details, Shabbat there steps aside when a person is to drive a car to go to Yerushalayim to testify to the seeing the first visibility of the new moon. He is not violating anything because Shabbat removed itself from the scene at God's command, of course, in order to allow and even require this testimony. No such violation of Shabbat is involved in our fixed calendar. It's a calculation. Anybody that learns through the Rambam, Hilchot Kiddush HaChodesh, can make the calculations himself. In fact, that was a class project when I taught 7th grade with a small group of boys where we did it on computer, and it's a program that I've polished and used ever since. So it's accessible, and no question about doing anything on Shabbat that shouldn't be done. Yet, the point that I'm trying to make is even though, according to Rambam, Plan A and Plan B, when there is a Sanhedrin and when there isn't a Sanhedrin, are both, according to Rambam, Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai, part of the oral law, there is a vast preference on God's part to Plan A. Think about this for a moment. I told you that the court has to make the calculations, not the easy calculations in our fixed calendar, but the more complex calculations involving astronomy, as well as math, in order to determine each month when the moon might be visible and where. So, from a knowledge perspective, witnesses are unnecessary. I mentioned also that the court has the discretionary power, if witnesses don't show up when they must in order to keep the calendar on even keel, the court can proclaim Rosh Chodesh without witnesses. So how come that wasn't built into the Friday night situation? If the witnesses are really not that necessary and Rosh Chodesh can still proceed, how come the halakha was not developed that says, if it's Friday night, don't come by car. We will let the court use its discretionary powers and proclaim Rosh Chodesh, even without eyewitnesses. The answer is, God is calling the shots here. And he said, my Shabbat will step aside, because I want this active participation of the Jewish people in setting up of their calendar. This is not like God sanctified Shabbat because he created the world in 7 days and 6 days and rested on the seventh. This is different. You, he says to us, the Jewish people were enslaved in Egypt, and you came out of Egypt, and you had all of those experiences, and the holidays of the year and the calendar on which they are based and the Rosh Chodesh are yours to declare, yours to make. And the high preference is for that human participation in the process. I'm left with about 20 seconds, and I want to emphasize that our plan B is kosher. It belongs now without a Sanhedrin, but it is because we lost the Sanhedrin. And that's tied in, not directly, but it's tied in to losing the Beit HaMikdash. And that's what we need to pray for. May we see it in our time. Shabbat Shalom, Chodesh Tov, Lehishtameah.